Testing, testing, testing. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Test, test, test. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. So we're at 18 here. Hello, hello, hello. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, go ahead. Give me a...
Hello. 1, 2, 1, 2. Testing, testing.
Okay, good to go. All right, so we should be good. The phone number is...
Yeah, I think it's a cell one.
Yeah. These 206 is probably not working anymore. Okay, this cell is 206-919. We're going to have to close the window. You know why?
It's too loud.
Yep.
Okay.
Lawnmowers and whistleblower and weed. Better. Thank you. 5305.
Hello.
Hello, John Marslup. Michael Olson tuning in with Vanessa here. How are you?
Good, good.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Now, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe you're doing Meadowlarks. How did you make that transition? Now, don't tell me yet, because I'll have to ask you that. But it's going to be fun. So I guess we're just about ready to go. You sound good. Would you give me a count to five, please?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I think he sounds pretty good. What do you think, yep, Vanessa? Sounds he sounds good. Okay, so we're ready to go. Now, you're in Bozeman?
Yes, I am.
Aha. I was there last year for a few weeks working, actually. So what a beautiful place that's become. And couldn't believe the amount of business jets flying in. Look like honeybees on a hot summer day.
It's crazy, for yeah. sure, but... We're just on the edge of town, so nice and quiet.
Good for you. Okay, I will do a countdown, and then we will take off here. Looks like we're all ready to go. What I need to do, of course, is this. Pull you up a little bit. Where do I click this? There.
Technology.
Oh, there's so many buttons to push in life, and only young people like Vanessa here can figure it out. The rest of us are completely buffaloed here. Okay, I think we're ready to go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Yellowstone Park in winter is a cruel place for the wildlife that can't endure its cold, snow, and lack of food. And yet, what is cruel for some can be a blessing for others. And so we ask, can anyone love the blackbirds of Yellowstone's white winter?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1357th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Port Villa who are tuned into the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Vanessa Salas on the stories. Vanessa, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Folks, Vanessa, of course, is our intern producer from the University of California Agroecology Program. So learning how to grow some good carrots, right?
Yep, excited for the show.
All right. Well, folks, there was a stretch of years back then when my wife Marlene and I would sneak off to Cook City, Montana for some cross-country skiing. In winter, Cook is the snowbound little town at the very end of the only open road through Yellowstone Park. Though Cook City is well known among snowmobiles for its access to the stunningly beautiful high country, snowmobilers and cross-country skiers are not of a kind. Our aim as skiers was Yellowstone's Lamar River Valley, which is, thankfully, off limits to the noisy, smelly snowmobiles. The Lamar is the wintering grounds for many of Yellowstone's animal populations, and our cross-country skis allowed us to fly over the surface of snowpacks. The animals had to plow their way through. We were not the only ones flying about the Lamar with such abandon. So, too, were the corvids, Yellowstone's blackbirds on white snow. Yellowstone's winter is a cruel time for the animals that can no longer survive the cold, snow, and lack of food. But from what I saw while flying over the snow-packed landscape was that winter was treating crows and ravens with a lot of opportunity to feast. And their feasting often sounded as raucous as an out-of-bounds wedding celebration. From watching their feasting and from watching them watch us as we flew across the landscape, we came to see corvids as being winners of Yellowstone's season of losing, and we wondered, can anyone love the blackbirds of Yellowstone's white winter? And then we ran across John Marslove, who is an emeritus professor of forest sciences at the University of Washington. John Marslove, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back.
Yeah, the last time we spoke back in Food Chain number 1050, we discussed the conquering crows. And, of course, you told us a little bit about how you went from being a forest scientist to a corvid specialist. And how did you make that transition?
Well, the corvids rule the forest as well as the Yellowstone scene that you described. And they're important predators and they're important competitors and scavengers in the system. So as we tried to understand how some of the rarer birds were eking out a living in forests, we came to discover the corvids as a potential threat to them and focused our efforts on them at that point.
Mm-hmm. And once you did, you became pretty fascinated, started taking your students to Yellowstone Park, say, look at these guys, right?
Absolutely. 26 years now we've brought students here. I was just arranging for this year's trip a few minutes ago.
Wow. So maybe we should invite the whole country to go with you because it sounds pretty fascinating to me. That would love to have that trip. Well, you went from crows to ravens to something else. So I'd like to do, as we're playing along here, a little sound identification to see if you can recognize these for us. Okay, here's something. Well, maybe it won't work.
It was a crow in a box.
It was a crow in a box. Well, I had it here, but it's just not pinging. So I guess I'll have to do without my sound effects that I spent hours last night working on. But that's the way of it. So what is the difference between crows and blackbirds for those of us who don't, like Vanessa here, who don't really know what the difference is?
Well, blackbirds are in a different family. They're icterids, and they include orioles and lots of other birds related to blackbirds. They're a more recently evolved lineage of birds than the corvids. Corvids are one of the first evolved groups of the passerines, the songbirds. And the crows and ravens are among the largest songbirds in the world, the raven being the largest one. So the difference between crows and ravens within the corvid group, ravens are about twice the size or so of a crow. They commonly are in just pairs or large aggregations at feeding sites. They're not as social throughout the year as the crow is, which is typically found in smaller family groups and larger flocks at food sources as well. But they're similar. They are both generalists. They're both really good survivors. The crow with people, the raven in the wilderness.
Okay, good. And speaking of the crow with people, when we last spoke way back when, you told the story of this wonderful trick you played on the crows at the University of UW-Washington campus, wherein you dressed up your students. Would you retell that story quickly for those who haven't heard it?
Sure. We were pretty convinced that these birds would recognize us after we would pay attention to them, go to their nests, work with them in detail to understand their biology. And so the trick we played was to wear a mask when we caught birds the next time on campus. And we wore a mask that looked like a caveman. And we caught 7 birds and let them go after tagging and measuring them. And then we'd walk around campus as the caveman to see the response of the crows to us. And we'd walk around as Dick Cheney, a different mask, to see if they would distinguish between a caveman and Cheney. And in fact, they did very strongly. They responded by scolding and mobbing us if we wore the caveman mask, but pretty much ignoring us if we wore no mask or the control Dick Cheney mask. And yeah, since we last spoke, in fact, there are a couple students donning masks today for year number 18 to see if the birds are still responding. I suspect they will. They did last year, 17 years after the capture, when, as far as I could tell, not a single one of the 7 birds that we had tagged was still alive. The last one, a female, died earlier in that year at an age of 19 years, at least. So these birds have been able to recognize individual people by their face, and they've passed on that knowledge through cooperative scolding and mobbing of a predator, and those that don't know of that predator learn by joining the mob and seeing who's attracted all the attention.
Wow. So somehow they transmit that knowledge by watch how we scold and mob this creature in this funny mask. Because you have to pay attention to this person right here because their great-great-grandfather captured us once.
Yeah.
And we're never going to forget that they did that.
And you better believe us. They're going entirely on faith at this point.
Wow. Well, that really indicates that the crows, at least, are very, very social critters.
Absolutely, and that pays off. I mean, rather than having to learn by your own mistakes, you can learn by observing others and gain knowledge through that avenue as well as through your personal experiences.
Yeah. Well, having been raised down in Billings, I was always amazed that the Crow Indians called themselves the Crows and not like the Bald Eagles or something like that.
But that's an interesting story. They should be the Ravens. That's actually the bird I think they used as their totem. And that's how Lewis and Clark had described them, that they had said, the Absorkee. And they basically they were confused. The Raven and Crow were confused by early French missionaries. And that's how I think the name Crow got stuck to that tribe. They rightfully are Ravens.
Yeah, but in thinking about it, I think Crow is a very good name for a family or an extended family or like a tribe.
Okay.
Because it really does indicate that you're working together on something, whereas ravens are kind of like solitary. And they go off on their own. They form family bonds, husband and wife bonds, if you will, but not so much to kids. Once kids can fly, they're booted out of the area. So the ravens are kind of like solitaries, whereas the... My show with you, I came to look at the Crow tribe as, clever people for naming themselves the Crows.
Exactly.
Huh. At any rate, so you, as a forester, that's really what you were, was it not, as a forester? You came
really
to...
more of a wildlife scientist along.
Is it kind of like a forest ecologist then?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And that term kind of has come to mean an all-encompassing term, where when you look at the ecology of something, you look at the whole system. And what you saw in looking at forests were these crows and these ravens.
Absolutely.
Now, you called them the rulers of the forest? Is that what you said?
Yeah, the rulers of the forest, the plains, wherever they occur, they are supremely adapted to being able to handle those conditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're taking over my neighborhood at times, much to the consternation of my wife, who likes songbirds. Now, it could be said that crows are songbirds, but not so much.
Well, technically they are. They're in the order Passeriformes in the birds, and that's a, you know, the lineage traced by early ancestral birds to have ones that have complex throat muscles, so they're able to make a variety of vocalizations. And the corvids, as anyone who's spent time around them knows, can make an awful lot of different sounds. And maybe not the pretty, beautiful song of a wren, but it's certainly complex, and that makes them a songbird.
Or of a meadowlark, right?
Certainly not as beautiful as a meadowlark.
Yeah. Okay, well, my goodness. I'm so disappointed in the fact that my sound effects didn't work, but we'll have to live with it. Crows and ravens have both distinctive vocal patterns. And when it gets right down to it, crows even sound more communal in their vocalization than ravens do. Ravens are like, and crows are more, quack, 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 quack. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's right. I would say quark, quark, quark for the raven, as opposed to the caw, caw of a crow. And yeah, to think of it as maybe more solitary for the raven, I think is okay.
Okay. Well, good. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're having fun. Today we're going to be traveling to Yellowstone Park in winter to have a look at those blackbirds on the white snow. When you see them there, they're really quite amazing. At first is the juxtaposition of black on white, but the exuberance with which they find something to eat is truly remarkable as well. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, and we are talking about what's eating what with John Marsloff, Emeritus Professor of Forest Sciences at University of Washington, and we will be right back. Oh, I'm kidding, it did that. But it's okay, I can erase it. All right, you'll have to be sure and knock me on the shoulder, Miss Vanessa, the next time that happens, and we'll go down here. Timer, hit the timer. Go down here and edit timer, and it's now 17. We go down here, and we start. Okay, we're getting it wired. And then we'll go. And
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back with John Marsloff and you. We're so happy that you joined us today for a little tour of Yellowstone Park. John, you've taken your students from the University of Washington. I'm kind of envious. How do you sign up for this? Or is it just for students?
Well, that one's for students. There are other options. The Yellowstone Forever is a group that is a philanthropy group for the park, and they offer all sorts of classes. My wife, Colleen, and I teach a raven and wolf class there, so anybody could take that.
Good. And what's the best season, in your estimation, to do this?
Best season is right now, the winter. As far as I'm concerned, there's a lot fewer people and a lot more wildlife to see.
Well, that's exactly what I think, too. And the Lamar River Valley?
The best. You know, I was there last weekend and will be heading back shortly, but it's beautiful. It's a extreme wilderness sort of landscape that you're immersed in. There's wolves, coyotes, foxes, ravens, magpies, eagles, anything you want. It's there.
And it's the only open road through Yellowstone Park that people can actually drive into, but don't tell anybody. Because if everybody finds out, it's going to be hard to drive through there. You know, John, I once did a radio show from a sheep rancher out of Big Timber, Montana. And the story was about the reintroduction of wolves. And we were doing a kitchen table live remote from his farm ranch house there. And as he was describing the problem of wolves eating his sheep, the back door of the kitchen open, and a person came in, a young man with a tracking antenna. And he looked at the poor rancher and he said, "She's back." And so I took the opportunity to sit him down at the table and put a microphone in front of him. And I asked him why we were reintroducing wolves into Yellowstone Park. Is it to control a population of deer and elk or something like that? No. We're reintroducing wolves into Yellowstone Park because city people want them there. I think he was right.
Yeah, technically. I mean, that's what motivated Babbitt, who was the Secretary of Interior then. His famous quote that he got his orders from the American people to add wolves back to the park. But, you know, it was an important missing link in the food chain that was there and had been there since the Pleistocene. And now that it's restored, I think we see a much more vibrant system, a much more ecologically complete system, and functioning much better for all involved, plants on up through the animals and scavengers.
And when it gets right down to it, your corvids and those wolves often form a team of sorts, correct?
Well, our work has shown that it's a team of sorts, but not nearly as tight of a team as previous literature and observations would have suggested.
Would you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Absolutely. In the past, people thought that perhaps a wolf and a raven, particular individuals, would have a tight relationship. Ravens would interact with wolves at the den. They might form a friendship with some of that pack, some of the members of the pack or the pups of the year, and they would then follow those wolves around to find food and occasionally lead wolves to food that wolves hadn't found. What we are finding is that ravens indeed follow wolves, but not every day, every minute, but occasionally check in on where the wolf packs are and use that information to find the kills that the wolves have made. And they're very quick at getting to kills immediately. In the daylight, after a kill or during a kill, the ravens are there. But it's very rare, but occasion, that it seems like wolves may home in on the noises that ravens make at a winter kill and find food that way. But it's much more of a parasitic relationship, ravens parasitizing the wolves and taking some of their food, as opposed to a mutualistic, symbiotic, teamwork sort of arrangement.
Right, right. Opportunistic, right?
Very opportunistic.
Okay, good. As a expert in corvids, of which there are a number, crows, ravens, jays, and magpies, if you were to adopt one as a pet for your grandchild, which one would it be?
That's a great question. It kind of depends on what you wanted to do. But if you want a real companion, like almost like a puppy, I would adopt a raven. They're much more likely to form a tight bond with you. But they're a handful. So, you know, they can bite hard, and they're a big animal. And so maybe for a small grandchild, a magpie would be the perfect sort of a pet, because they also are very talkative and very social, beautiful, and a little easier to handle.
A little bit smaller, yeah. Ravens could be. They can eat a lot, too, and that's something we want to get into. So let's get into, first of all, Yellowstone in winter. It is a magnificent landscape. Not so many cars, really hard to get into. You have to come in through essentially West Yellowstone, but you can't get very far into the park that way. But so you have to kind of go through Livingston, Montana, and up through Gardner, and then into the Lamar River Valley, which is, why is it so special there? Why is it that the Lamar has so many animals and so many animal sightings and so many people watching?
One, the accessibility, as you mentioned, it's one of the only, you know, direct routes into the heart of the park. You're getting up in higher elevation, and so the animals are a little more tested there. You've got a beautiful river running through the valley that attracts a lot of wildlife, waterfowl, dippers, eagles, otters. You've got wolves that were reintroduced in two parts of the Lamar during the initial reintroductions in the 90s. And there's been packs there from the start of the reintroduction. And it's just been kind of the center. It's part of what's called the Northern Range, which is the area occupied by a large elk herd in the park. And so the elk that were there are important prey for the wolves. It's open. It's mostly sage in the valley. And so you can see, and the visibility is really what makes this place special. There are a few places where you can actually see wolves hunting, feeding, and interacting socially with one another. And the visibility there, I think, is the real key difference. And the proximity and the ability to be on a road network where the wolves are used to that and aren't shying away from it, and people can have a good vantage point.
It's almost like a big screen movie theater where you can park your car and watch life take place in that beautifully, stunningly beautiful valley. And exactly. So in the summer, that's what you see parked along the Lamar Valley, or car after car after car with spotting telescopes and whatnot. It's kind of fun to watch the people watching the critters as they do. Now, in the winter, of course, not so many people at all. And when it gets right down to it, it's a tough place to live for the critters. And not a lot of critters, you know, that are very weak make it through that kind of winter. So you talked about, you know, the wolves being an important part, reintroduction to the ecosystem. Kind of give us a little thumbnail of why that reintroduction was so important to Yellowstone itself.
When I was an undergrad at the University of Montana in the 70s, we would come to Yellowstone to see the results of overgrazing. The ungulate populations, especially elk, had reached such high numbers that they were damaging the vegetation, and the loss of vegetation was leading to erosion. The erosion was leading to degraded streams where beavers and otters and things like that had a tougher time living. And so we were seeing the beginning of the crash of a beautiful ecosystem by having overpopulation of elk. And that was one of the main reasons for the reintroduction of wolves, because, of course, wildlife scientists back in the 30s and 40s had a federal mandate, basically, to get rid of predators, and that included in our national parks. And so with the removal of those, the ungulates increased. And with the reintroduction of those, the thought was that they would help reduce the ungulate population, or at least make it more wary and not concentrate so heavily in a place like the Valley Bottoms and the Lamar and Hayden Valley.
And so when you see the Lamar these days, it's much more like nature intended it to be rather than people intended it to be. And it looks very healthy these days with respect to the foliage and whatnot. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's definitely coming back. It's not just the overgrazing and now the reoccupation by wolves that's helping it, but there have been some serious droughts in the last decades that also set back vegetation and makes this recovery a lot slower and more patchy than you might expect. If it was just wolves, everything should be great now. But it's a combination of wolves and the climate, and how those two will play out over the next several decades will be interesting to see. But yeah, there are great spots in it. There are beavers right there at the Lamar River Bridge now, and things are coming back.
So everything is really beautiful throughout the year, and then winter comes and things really slow down. And it gets tough for the critters that are weak. And really, winter is what usually kind of takes them out when it gets right down to it. And you have a population of hungry wolves that, if you've ever heard the wolves howling, it's really quite spectacular and frightening. It kind of makes you shiver when you hear them. And so there are a very strong population of wolves. Wolves kill the weak, And then they're the corvid population to help clean up, right?
Exactly. The cleanup crew in nature. Well, magpies first, often. But ravens, if a wolf kill has just been made, ravens will be right there as the kill is happening. And they'll have to wait their turn for the wolves to eat first. But once the wolves are sated and go off to the side and sleep off that meal, the ravens flock in. 10, 20, 50 ravens, maybe up to 100 in some places, will be in there scavenging the leftovers and greatly reducing the food that's available there.
You know, having witnessed that cacophony, I made the remark, it sounds like a wedding party that got out of control, because it's really a racket they put up.
Yeah.
And something, a sight to behold when it gets right down to it. And you talk about which corvid gets in first to the kill.
It kind of depends. If the kill's made at night and is available at first light, it'll typically be the magpie that's there. They have a good sense of smell, and they live in smaller home ranges, so there's likely to be some magpies close to that kill site. And they're the first ones in, and they're very agile, and so they're very bold. They get right in, sneaking in among the wolves and grabbing a bite to eat. The raven's less agile, has to have more space to get in and out without getting caught by the wolves, which occasionally happens. And so they usually come in later, and they're working by vision, not so much smell.
Okay.
But if the kill is made during the day and wolves are out hunting, there will often be 1 to 4 or 5 ravens right with that party of wolves. So when the kill's made, they're right there. They might not be able to eat right away, but they're certainly the first to discover it.
How on earth did you go about studying birds flying around Yellowstone Park?
Well, we put radio transmitters on them, and my colleague in this is Matthias Loretto. He's an Austrian scientist at the University of Vienna, and Matthias received a grant that allowed us to buy 60 state-of-the-art radio transmitters that we put on our ravens, and as the ravens flew around, they took GPS locations every half hour on where the bird was and its movement through space, and relay that information through the cell network back to us. So we were able to, follow our birds remotely, but also then go in and see where they had been and encounter them and watch them at kills.
Kind of like following somebody's cell phone.
It was exactly. We had 60 flying cell phones out there, and it was fascinating to see where they were all going.
What kind of range does a raven have?
Well, our long-distance travel champion was a young male raven that I caught and banded at a dead bison in the Lamar, and it ended up settling just south of Calgary, about 700 kilometers north of where we caught it. Most of the ravens that are in the park are these what we call vagrant non-breeders, and they have these large travels, usually going 50 kilometers or so from starting to ending point in a given day, back in, covering at least that distance between the two most extreme locations in a day. The other ravens in the park are territorial and breeding pairs, and they have a more limited range during the breeding season, just about 5 miles or so around their nests. But again, during the winter, they're going about 50 miles from one point to the next, usually from their territory, commuting to a kill or to a human subsidy for their feeding.
Okay, we'll pick up the human subsidy when we get back. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, and we're talking about what the corvid population of Yellowstone Park eats in the winter especially, but also the rest of the time too, because we're curious. And the corvid population are pretty curious too. If you've ever had the opportunity to watch a raven or a crow watch you as you walk through the neighborhood, you got to believe that they are paying attention to you as much as they possibly can. This is The Food Chain. We will be right back with John Marslov. Gonna be fun. Don't go away. Okay, and in. How am I doing better? Okay. All right. Let's start. And
so much to say, so little time to say it on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
It is time to talk about corvids. Why? Because we think we have become fascinated with them. Did you ever think you'd become this fascinated with corvids, John Marslov?
Probably not initially. I actually wanted to study nuthatches. But in grad school, I got the opportunity to study pinion jays, and they're a corvid. And boy, once you get hooked on corvids, it's hard to look at other birds because nothing is as variable and as fun to watch, as innovative as watching any of the corvids.
They're like flying people, aren't they?
Certainly like flying monkeys. No okay. doubt about that. They've got big brains and they're social and long lived. So yeah, they're like us. Mm-hmm.
And I think perhaps that's the fascination with jays. My uncle had a magpie when I was growing up, and I was always fascinated with the magpie, which of course is a corvid. And now my wife tends jays in the backyard.
Nice.
So I guess once you get stuck on corvids, you're stuck on corvids, and here we are. You were talking about the society of breeders and non-breeders. Would you elaborate on that for the corvids?
Sure. In most corvids, the pair bond, the male-female breeding unit, is the organizational unit of the group. That's a very strong bond. It's a lifelong bond in all of the species of corvids. But depending upon the species and the habitats they live in, non-breeders may form permanent flocks. They might form aggregations at food like ravens, permanent flocks like some of the jays, like the pinion jay. So this social aspect of the birds outside of the pair bond is quite variable, and it kind of depends on the reliability and the accessibility of different foods.
They're almost like gangs, right?
Ravens, I think the non-breeders do function a lot like gangs. They have to have strength in numbers to overpower the more dominant, aggressive, territorial ravens that would dominate food otherwise.
So in essence, the breeders, as you call them, the husbands and wives who establish a territory, fight like crazy to keep everybody else out.
Absolutely. That's the key to their success. The effort they put into it allows them to have first access, if not universal access, to the resources in that territory.
And then you were talking about how the non-breeders fly long distances. I suspect looking for an opportunity to eat something that the residents haven't yet figured out was there.
Exactly. Or it's too spread out or too predictable, too rich for the territorial birds to bother trying to fight all the time. So, for example, some of the human resources like a garbage dump that ravens will forage at, it wouldn't be worth a territorial pair to try to defend that big space. Because there's always food there. There's no reason to try to keep it to yourself from that standpoint. And by being so attractive, there's so many other birds there, they would spend all their time chasing each other or chasing the other birds around and very little time feeding for themselves.
And you talked about human sources of foods for the corvids.
They're essential. Our ravens in Yellowstone, in the heart of Yellowstone, as soon as the elk hunting season starts outside of the park, the ravens start commuting daily to the places where hunters are killing elk and leaving gut piles, the remains of the elk that they don't take. And the ravens are right in on those. And so are the eagles and bears and coyotes and wolves.
So it's a great time to feed. Also, garbage dumps?
Garbage dumps and even wastewater treatment plants. Their wastewater treatment plants have grease that floats up in the lagoons that are there, the water, and blows to one side with the wind. And the ravens just sit there and slurp it up. Mm-hmm. And that's high energy, high caloric energy food, easy to get, indefensible because there's so much of it. And so the birds spend a lot of time at wastewater treatment plants eating fat.
Because in nature, it's probably some of the hardest stuff to get, isn't it?
Certainly, you're not going to get as much energy in a small packet as you are if you get fat. So, yeah, the wolves are taking that part of their kills quickly, and not as much of that rich, high-calorie food is available for scavengers. So, yeah, take advantage of it at a place that we use it as a waste product.
And how do the corvids get along with the other flying critters like eagles and ospreys and such, hawks and
they pretty much ignore osprey except maybe trying to steal a fish from them. It's interesting. We did experiments with crows where we put out a stuffed red-tail hawk and a stuffed osprey, and they will mob and harass the red-tail because it's a potential predator on them or their young. But the osprey, they pretty much leave alone. Here in the park, in the wintertime, they're dealing mainly with bald eagles and golden eagles. And golden eagles are a tough predator. They are one of the few animals that can kill ravens. And so ravens give them a wide berth. If the eagle comes into to a food source, whether it's from hunters or from wolves, the eagle or the ravens back off. And once the eagle gets its fill, which is pretty quick, and steps off to the side, the ravens and magpies are right back in.
And talking about and speaking of taking their fill, the ravens and the crows are very good at taking their fill and a bunch more too, right?
Yeah, they keep taking food and they store it, cache it, we call it. Store it in the ground usually, move it away from the actual food source so that they could then access that later.
And our backyard corvids, I notice, do the same thing.
I'm sure with seeds and things, yeah.
Yeah, with nuts and seeds. And sure, they'll take it and disappear and then come back for more. And so one wonders what they're up to. They're just storing things for other times. And then those stash, how much can they stash? You had some great statistics there that left me flabbergasted.
Yeah, they can store nutcrackers, for example. They're the king of this, and they store hundreds of thousands of pine seeds during each autumn and remember where they placed all of those seeds throughout the rest of the year as they depend upon that for their primary food. Ravens and crows are more scatter hoarders, we call it, and they take food as long as it's available, scatter it around pretty close to the actual source of the food. And, you know, ravens might in this way take several pounds of meat away from a kill site and store it for later use. Crows taking peanuts and things, you know, as long as they're available, they're going to keep coming and taking them and caching them. Here at our house, we've been trapping magpies to band them and study them a bit more as well. And we use Cheetos as bait. And we're finding Cheetos in our trees and in our around our sheds and all over the place. So they can't help themselves.
So they take as much as they. You made mention of one. I think it was a corvid that was found to take a huge chunk of a moose.
They can take. Probably about a quarter of a kill like that. If there's not a coyote or wolves that are eating it as well, if they're left to their own device, they will take about a quarter of that over the course of several days and cache it. Yep.
Wow. Incredible. Now, I'm curious to know about the impact COVID populations have on your students. Because when most of us go to Yellowstone Park, even in the winter or whatnot, we're looking for, you know, animals and not so much birds.
Yeah.
But it's really that the bird population is immensely fascinating as well. How do your students react when you open their eyes to the birds?
They definitely gain an appreciation for them. But I tell you, if a wolf walks by, they're watching the wolf. If a moose is there, they're watching the moose. So I try. We try.
Uh-huh.
But they definitely appreciate it more. Once they start seeing the ability to gather so much information on birds also, they're diurnal, they're visible. With our trackers, they're even more accessible. Then they start to appreciate it from a scientific standpoint. Hey, this is a species I can really learn something about. These are data that I can delve into in many different ways and practice my quantitative skills and things like that. So they actually, I think, become much more interested in them from not only the, you know, the beauty of seeing them soaring or fighting for food, but also from the practical standpoint of if you want to be a scientist, you have to get information, and you can get a lot more information on animals that are abundant and observable than ones that are great to see but reticent and much rarer on the landscape. So we try to build their curiosity and their wonder about these animals from a couple of different ways.
And of those people who are have really taken to Yellowstone for its animals, what would you suggest would be a good way for them to open their own eyes to the populations of corvids and whatnot? Take binoculars with you, right?
Of course, binoculars, scopes as well, but also to sit and watch around some of these human resources as well. So picnic areas, for example, you might see some bighorn sheep off to the side of a picnic area, but you're likely to have a raven come in and try to take your food, try to outsmart you to get your sandwich. Or if you park long enough at some of the pull-offs where you might be watching wolves in the far distance, miles away, right alongside of you comes walking a raven that stops and looks you in the eye, just like a puppy, and is begging for food from you, maybe even vocalizing. And their vocalizations are also another entree to their unique abilities. They're so variable and intriguing to listen to. And if you pay attention to what's right at your feet, I think you're likely to build an interest in the corvids as well.
And they're that close. Now, corvids in the cities, why do I see corvids taking over my neighborhood? At times, not all the time, but sometimes crows by the zillions seem to congregate in our neighborhood. And why do they congregate like that in cities? And I've actually done stories. I think Riverton, Wyoming was completely taken over by the corvids, and nobody could do anything about it. And so finally the Chamber of Commerce sold umbrellas.
And in Bothell, Washington, they have celebrations for the crows that roost there every night by the thousands. So, you can embrace them and, you know, just join in and appreciate the spectacle that they have, especially around in the evening time when they come into roost in cities, because they use them at that time because they're safer and they're warmer than being out in the wilds where owls could eat them more frequently. And it's colder and harsher. So they go into cities for protection, but primarily they're in there year-round for food. And for the way we have fragmented habitat, whether it's a grassland that we planted trees in or a treed area that we've logged some of the area and planted lawns and placed our houses there, that fragmentation of whatever was the natural habitat has played right into the corvid's hand, because then they can play both worlds. They can be in the protection of the trees as needed, and in the open for foraging. And with our bird feeders, with our plantings of ornamental fruits and berries, we provided a tremendous amount of food, let alone our waste products, which also provide a tremendous amount of food for these animals. So
there. Well, I have a couple minutes left, John, but I have to ask you, how did a corvid expert go from corvids to meadowlarks?
Well, meadowlarks always fascinated me as a kid growing up in Kansas. They're one of the most important birds there. They are beautiful in their song, as we alluded to early. Their striking coloration is great. And they're a symbol of the impact we have had on grasslands around the world and the species of birds that have declined in response to that. And so they're just a signal to me of what we have done to our more open lands that have caused the reduction in so many of our marvelous species of birds.
And thus, your new book, In Search of Meadowlarks.
Yep, and my search to try to understand why their numbers have declined and to see from farmers around the world how they are coexisting with wildlife rather than excluding it.
Well, I hope we can capture you. Well, maybe we can set a trap for you with some Cheetos so we can get you to join us again for A Search of Meadowlarks. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Olson, this has been a wonderful hour for me. I love talking about birds with John Marslove. What could be more fun? Hopefully we can pick him up for a discussion of meadowlarks and farming. And I want to thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Thank you, John.
You bet, Michael. My pleasure.
All right.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.